Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by audible.co.uk. Download one title each month, plus unlimited listening to thousands of Audible originals, podcasts, and audiobooks. Just click on the Audible banner at www.tre.radio.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. As always, we start by looking at the bestseller lists on Amazon.co.uk and the Sunday Times, the oldest and most influential book sales chart in the UK. There are lots of new entries this week. We'll be chatting to Celia Silvani, who's a communications director and freelance writer who has written on topics ranging from weddings to hurricanes. Her debut novel, Baby Teeth, explores themes of free birthing, infertility, motherhood, and the choices mothers make in pregnancy and beyond. We're also chatting to Anthony Etherington, who's written several teleplays and screen dramas. His latest novel, Some Other Eden, is part kidnap thriller, part family drama, part love story. It's a gripping tale of resilience and courage in an increasingly turbulent and fragmented world. It's set in Cairo in 2010. We're chatting to Lee Coates, who almost gave up on his dream of writing a novel after having children, as spare time became a rare commodity. But a light bulb moment struck during one of his son's extracurricular activities. Smiley Face is a psychological thriller set in Cardiff, following Simon and his young son as they try to rebuild their lives after the tragic death of his wife years earlier. Their newfound tranquility shatters when a local schoolboy mysteriously dies, revealing a disturbing pattern of incidents involving children. That's just the first hour. In the second hour, we're chatting to Barney Campbell, Jana Brooke Wallach, Andy Pliego, and Nina Winter.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
The pen's in my hand, ending unplanned. Staring at the blank page before you, open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate.
Good evening. Welcome to this week's book show. We start by looking at the Sunday Times bestseller list, the oldest and most influential book sales chart in the UK and the one that every author wants to be on. This chart is the most accurate and comprehensive estimation of book sales in the country. So starting with general hardbacks, there are four new entries from last week, including number one on Democracies and Death Cults by Douglas Murray, why Western support for the Palestinian cause could fortify dangerous forces. Number two, The Let Them Theory by Mel Robbins. Number three, a new entry called Fahrenheit 182 by Mark Hoppus, the vocalist, bassist and founding member of the pop punk band Blink 182 reveals all. Number four this week is Careless People by Sarah Wynne Williams. Number five, a new entry called The Accidental Soldier by Owain Mulligan, an honest account of what life was like for a member of the British Army in Iraq. And the final new entry is at six, Tommy Innitt's Guide to Survival by Tom Simmons. Navigate life's biggest, baddest and stupidest challenges with the YouTuber's advice. Number 7 is Spring, The Story of a Season by Michael Morpurgo. Number 8, Confidence by Roxy Nafusi. Number 9, What's Your Dream by Simon Squibb. And number 10 is John and Paul by Ian Leslie. Looking at fiction hardbacks, there are 7 new entries this week, including number 1, The Monster of Mine by Shalini Abi Sakara. A magical prosecutor solves cases for a judge by day and plots his ruin by night. A new entry at 2, Firebird by Juliet Cross. A Roman general who can turn into a dragon fights to save a bewitching dancer. New entry at 3, Marble Hall Murders by Anthony Horowitz. Clues leading to the truth behind an author's death are hidden in a mystery novel. Number 4 is Onyx Storm by Rebecca Yarros. Number 5, a new entry called Swept Away by Beth O'Leary. Two strangers find themselves stranded at sea after a one-night stand. New entry at 6, The Book That Held Her Heart by Mark Lawrence. A mysterious library is at the centre of a battle between knowledge and ignorance. Number 7, a new entry by David Baldacci called Strangers in Time. Two teenagers find an ally in the bookshop owner during the Second World War. And the final new entry at 8, The Cat Who Saved the Library by Susuki Natsukawa. A talking cat and a bibliophile investigate why books are disappearing from a library. Number 9 is Nobody's Fool by Harlan Coben. And number 10, Dream Count by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. Looking at bestsellers on Amazon.co.uk, still at number 1 is Sunrise on the Reaping, the latest book in The Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins. Number 2, Cozy Corner, a calm and comforting colouring book for all ages by Coco Wyo. Number 3, On Democracies and Death Cults by Douglas Murray. Number 4, Fearless, the epic conclusion to the Powerless trilogy by Lauren Roberts. Number 5, The Housemaid is back in the charts by Frieda McFadden. Number 6, Easy 10, 10 Everyday Ingredients, 100 Fuss-Free Dinner Recipes by Amy Shepherd. Number 7, Pinch of Nom Air Fryer by Kay Allinson. Number 8, There's a Bunny in Your Book. Number 11 in the Who's in Your Book series by Tom Fletcher. Number 9 is Iron Flame by Rebecca Yarros. And number 10, The Let Them Theory by Mel Robbins.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
You're listening to The Book Club on Talk Radio Europe. And keep listening. That's an instruction from Margaret Thatcher.
Joining us on the line now is Celia Silvani. She's a communications director and freelance writer who's written on topics ranging from weddings to hurricanes. She's with us on the book show to talk about her debut novel, Baby Teeth. The book explores themes of free birthing, infertility, motherhood, and the choices mothers make in pregnancy and beyond. Welcome to the book show, Celia.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for joining us and congratulations on your debut novel.
Thank you so much. It's still so surreal and exciting to be able to say I'm a published author.
Oh, I bet. Nice one. So dare I ask the inspiration for this book?
Of course. So the inspiration came to me back in lockdown. I read a very harrowing article titled I Brainwashed Myself with the Internet, which detailed one woman's experience with a free birthing forum and how it led to some devastating decisions. I had never heard of free birthing before, and this woman's story, which is very upsetting, it absolutely haunted me, and I could not get the idea out of my mind of why would someone trust the internet over healthcare professionals? And what would someone's background and life be like to kind of inform that kind of decision making? And the story really stemmed from there.
Wow. So I must admit, I'm not familiar with free birthing either. Can you explain what it is?
Absolutely. So free birthing is a legal antenatal decision that some people make around the world for lots of different reasons, where you do not want to have any kind of medical intervention during your pregnancy and birth. It can be for lots of different reasons. So, for example, it could be from someone's cultural background. But, and this is what's explored in my book, some people choose to free birth because they feel very traumatized by healthcare, or they also want to feel like they are in complete control of their bodies for whatever reason. Mm. Again, I had honestly never heard of this, so I did an almost unbelievable amount of research. My poor husband in lockdown was like, please don't tell me you're reading again. I'd be like, sorry, I can't stop learning about this. And yeah, there's just a lot of reasons for it. It's definitely seen as contentious by some healthcare professionals, but it's also it's a growing and legal choice that people make.
Right. And presumably you on the internet, you can find some really positive stories about it as well as some really negative ones.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the internet, and this is very much what my book explores, is it contains an overwhelming amount of advice and stories and experiences. And yeah, absolutely. Much like any kind of birth story, there is a whole spectrum of information out there.
Yeah. So can you tell us a bit about this awful story that you read that inspired this book?
Yes. So I would just like to say it might be quite upsetting for some people to hear. My book does carry a trigger warning as well, that it does contain a scene of pregnancy loss. So in this story, this true account written by a woman, which first inspired the idea for Baby Teeth, a woman and her partner are considering different options during the pregnancy, and they decide to undergo a completely, what's called a wild pregnancy, which is just, yeah, absolutely no contact with healthcare professionals of any kind. And she gets to 40 weeks, which is in many places seen as like you are absolutely full term. And the pregnancy continued and continued, and the community she was part of encouraged her to keep going with the pregnancy until 45 weeks, when unfortunately that child passed in utero, which is just absolutely so, so upsetting and awful. And this woman expresses in her true account her deep regret for being part of those communities, which I won't spoil my book, isn't necessarily the case for my characters in my story.
Okay. Yeah, one of the big things that you talk about in the book are these online communities, and when people are offering health advice or support when they don't really have any trained experience in that is quite worrying and scary, and as in this woman's case, can have tragic consequences.
Yes. I think the thing about the internet is, and I speak from personal experience here, not necessarily relating to pregnancy and birth, but just generally life. Like, I'm very much of the generation where the internet is pretty much always the first place I go to for advice, from things ranging from how do I get this stain out of my top to, you know, very quite impactful health related decisions. And the internet can be such a balm, especially for loneliness. And one thing that book really explores is the profound impact of loneliness. And loneliness in contexts where you might not necessarily expect them. So, for example, my main character, Claire, she's married, but she also feels extremely unseen and unheard and alone. And so for her, the internet offers her this fantastic sense of support and community and instant connection with people. But then also it can be dangerous. You know, the book explores the dangers of the internet and digital echo chambers. And that's something that I think is really interesting and really important, because people, when they go onto the internet, and I'm talking about myself also here, like if I go and Google something, you have to always remind yourself, like, anyone can be saying anything and you don't know their background or credentials.
Yeah, or reasons for saying it, whether they've got an agenda or anything like that. There can be so many reasons for their opinions or comments that they're giving.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So another thing you talk about, discussing the gap between what we think motherhood would be like and the actual experience, because again, that can be very different. And everybody's experience of motherhood and giving birth, again, is very different. There will be people that say, oh, you have to have the C-section. Best thing I ever did. Don't bother with natural birth. This is the way to go. And then other people who had complications with their C-section and will say never again, always have a natural birth. You know, it depends on people's personal experiences.
It's so true. What was quite interesting is that I wrote this book long before becoming a mother myself.
Oh, wow, that's interesting.
So it was the all... And what I find quite interesting when I say that is I made very few changes to the fundamental presentation of expectation versus reality of pregnancy and motherhood after I then became a parent myself. I spoke to so many people who were parents. And like I said, I listened to pretty much, I think, every podcast, YouTube, read every article, you know, scoured Facebook groups to really make sure I was learning as much as possible and speaking to the right people. But yes, it's so true. Like you have, there's just an overwhelming amount of advice and opinions out there. And people can be very defensive of the decisions they've made, and it's such a fraught emotional experience, pregnancy and motherhood, or and indeed the process of, for some people, of trying to become a parent, that it's just a it can lead to a lot of tension, which isn't great when it comes to having conversations with people about pregnancy and motherhood, but really does help when you're writing a book full of suspense.
And people can be very judgy as well, can't they? You know, I'm thinking of the subject of breastfeeding versus bottle feeding as an example. You know, a lot of people will say, oh, breast is best. This is the way you must do it. It brings you closer to your baby. And then for mothers that can't breastfeed or struggle to breastfeed for whatever reason, can be made to feel bad or guilty that they're not doing it correctly or they're not as good a mother as people who are breastfeeding, which is just horrendous.
It's horrendous. There's just so much pressure and expectation. And also I think I first wrote this book in lockdown, so 5 years ago. And since then, use of social media for sharing like these, like I'm doing a air quotes here, like realistic day in the life of parenthood. It really has created far more in those 5 years of like a performance of pregnancy and motherhood online that I think is just quite unsettling and can be really upsetting for people, you know, on all of those very emotional topics, like your experience of trying to get pregnant, giving birth, and what happens to you. You know, some people have birth plans that really do not go to plan and have deep trauma as a result. And then it comes to feeding and weaning and then what you're feeding your child. It's never ending.
Yeah. And another thing which I think all women hopefully will be able to understand, but obviously you still get a lot of female trolls online, so they're not always that understanding of each other, sadly. But the amount of emotions, because of hormone levels I'm talking, that can be all over the place during either the process of trying to conceive, that some women can experience just on a monthly basis with their periods, but when you have conceived, going through pregnancy, postpartum, you know, the hormones throughout for so many years can literally be all over the place, which makes it even harder. You know, women are that much more vulnerable during these times, and to be attacked and feel like you're doing something wrong, it's not okay, is it?
It's difficult. I'm currently 35 weeks pregnant with my second, so
oh, wow.
I'm really experiencing a lot of hormones and emotions myself right now. But no, it is so true. It's such a fragile, vulnerable time, and there are so many expectations and pressures that come from external sources, but also with the relationship we have with the internet, like that we can put on ourselves. And I think it's just, I asked my mum, like, what was it like raising me and my sister in the time before the internet? And she was like, oh, I haven't really thought about it. And I was like, but you know, if you wanted some advice, what did you do? She was like, oh, I'd go to the GP. It's like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's better or worse. I'll be interested in other people's opinions, but it's just, there's just so much information out there and it can be so difficult.
Yeah. I remember my mum saying there was, I can't remember who the author was now. I know I interviewed her years ago. She's no longer with us now, but a woman who had written this book about woman and baby or something like that it was called. And it was like the Bible for women and mothers in the 70s and 80s. And yeah, she read that from cover to cover and that was kind of her point of reference and I suppose a lot of other women in that time. But comparing that to now, one book compared to a whole internet of information, I mean, it's crazy, isn't it?
It is wild. It is really wild to me. I think for anyone that's having a really difficult time in whatever stage of trying to get pregnant or has a child, like I just want to hug that person. I wanted to hug my main character, Claire, whilst writing her and be like, it is okay. You're going to be okay. Please. Such a difficult time.
And there's a real difference between telling someone about your personal experiences with it to giving advice to telling someone what they should do. You know, they're three very different things. And I think with pregnancy and birth, I think even the GP, to be honest, nobody should tell the mother what they should or shouldn't do, unless we're in a life or death situation type thing. But, you know, there's advice. There's, well, this is what I did. This is what worked for me. But every woman is different. You know, that's fine getting that kind of information. But it's dangerous when people online are saying, oh, this is what you need to do. You should do this, when it could have, yeah, disastrous consequences.
I completely agree with you there. It can have such disastrous consequences, and it also can have consequences that can make the person feel really upset for, you know, less grave reasons. There was this article in The Guardian last week by Rhiannon and Lucy Coslett, who has this column called Republic of Parenthood. And it says, new mums are being strongly encouraged to get regular exercise and get more sleep. Ha 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 ha. That's the headline. And I think that's just to your point around like telling people what to do. It can just make you feel really awful. And I think what the book really explores is just how isolating the whole parenthood experience can be and how damaging that isolation can really be on an individual.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about you, without giving too much away, obviously. Can you tell us a bit about your main character, Claire, and what she goes through?
Yes. So Claire is a very lonely woman who's relocated from the northeast to London with her husband, who has been trying to conceive and has been really struggling. And she initially finds solace in an online, you know, trying to conceive for him. And when she gets pregnant, slight spoiler, she really falls down the rabbit hole of increasingly insular communities, one of which takes a very cult-like turn, and something very devastating happens to someone she's very close to in that group. And it really taps into what we've been discussing, you know, motherhood, advice, anxiety and health anxiety, whether the internet is a positive or a negative thing, and just how the lengths some people go to find connection.
Yeah, it's such a shame, isn't it? Because so many of these online communities, whether it's to do with giving birth or anything, can be a real lifeline for people and can be a really positive, amazing experience, particularly if they're struggling with loneliness or isolation. But they can so easily take a negative turn. Someone can come onto the group and say something really mean or judgmental and totally change and ruin the experience.
Yeah, it's so true. And I just think there's so little comprehensive research out there on whether social media is a good or a bad thing for our brains. Like, and I'm sure the next generation, when they're older, will have a far more research and knowledge on whether they should be making some of the decisions we make when it comes to how we find information out and who to trust, and just like how much misinformation can be out there.
Mm. Just reminded me of something that happened to my mother, actually, quite a few years ago. She's sadly no longer with us. She was part of a group online, a vegan community. She was passionately vegan, and she loved being part of this community. She didn't know any of these people, you know, never met them, but they all had this shared bond and passion about being vegan. And it was lovely. And she was constantly saying, oh, you know, these people are lovely, what lovely and wonderful. And it brought her a lot of joy. And then she made some comment about honey. Someone had was suffering with a sore throat, and she said, oh, if you get hold of some local honey, it's so good for you. And then someone completely went to town on her. I thought you were a vegan. How can you eat honey? It's bad for the bees, and you don't care about animals like you said you did. And I mean, it was absolutely vile, the abuse that she got. And it really traumatized her. It really upset her. She felt like she had this safe space, and suddenly she was being attacked, and her whole character was being attacked, and as if she, you know, wasn't the person that she said she was. Oh, it was really awful. It was really, really upsetting to her. I'd forgotten that.
I'm so sorry to hear that. And I'm so sorry to hear she's also no longer with you. But yeah, that's really sad. And I think an experience that a lot of people will probably relate to, of just thinking that this corner of the internet is a little safe haven, but you actually don't know who these people are, and things can just take a turn. It's the fact that people express themselves on the internet in a way very few would in real life, face to face. That can just be so difficult and upsetting when you're on the receiving end of it.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's been really great to have you with us, Celia Silvani. Thanks so much for joining us. Some really important subjects we've discussed today. And if people want to get a copy of Baby Teeth, it's out now. It's available on our website, tre.radio. Can I ask you why it's called Baby Teeth?
Of course, it's called Baby Teeth because it's meant to evoke a sense of something being quite dark and unsettling. It was previously called brooding, but it was deemed to be a little bit too on the nose. So for anyone that's seen the book cover, it's got a very dark image of a very unsettling picture of a cot, an empty cot, and an unused stack of baby books. So you're meant to feel slightly prepared for a book that's got some quite uneasy and difficult themes contained inside.
Yes. Well, Baby Teeth is available now on our website, tre.radio. Celia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Anthony Etherington. He's written several teleplays and screen dramas. One of these, Yellow Dragon and the Red Fox, won Best Screenplay Awards at the European Independent Film Festival and the International Film Festival of Wales in 2014. His debut novel, Europia, was published in 2022, and he's with us on the book show to talk about his second novel, Some Other Eden. It's described as part kidnap thriller, part family drama, part love story. It's a gripping tale of resilience and courage in an increasingly turbulent and fragmented world, and it's partly set in Cairo in 2010. Welcome to the book show, Anthony.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Great to have you with us. So why this particular setting? Why Cairo? Why 2010?
I got to a stage when I was looking for my second novel to revisit some of the places I'd been in my working life and pull them together. So I'd worked in the Middle East quite a bit, in Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Dubai. I'd also worked a while in Israel some time back. So pulling all those threads, one of the things that struck me when I spoke to people outside the courses I was involved in or the recruitment I was doing, was how similar people are. And I thought about this whilst I was working there, plus when I came home, and eventually characters emerged that wanted to tell the story of how, in essence, we have more in common than divides us.
Mm, yeah, interesting, because it's very easy to think and assume that people must be very, very different because of their background or their economic circumstances or whatever. But that's an interesting observation.
Yes, I mean, it seemed to ring true whether I was working out in the fields or in a boardroom in a bank in downtown Riyadh. So, you know, it was taken from a host of situations. Mm-hmm. And I think the problem is so often the headlines dominate our view of the world. And in fact, you know, real life isn't always the headlines.
Mm, absolutely. So tell us about your main character, Jeff Ward.
Jeff Ward, yes. Well, I wanted someone who was slightly unsympathetic at first, because I've met guys like this, and I'm sure we've all come across people who think they have the answers to life and, you know, who often have a good setup, a good life, but who don't necessarily take into account the views of those around them. They believe that they're caring and loving, and they probably are caring and loving, but as long as, if you like, it's on in my way, the way I want you to do things. So can be rather dominant personalities at times. Mm-hmm. So Jeff, you know, starts off with a very strong and clear picture of where he is in life and what he wants in life. He has a lovely wife, he has two great kids, and everything seems to be hunky-dory, especially when a few years before the novel starts, he sets out on his own, setting up his own business in a management development consultancy.
So he visits Cairo.
He does indeed, yes. He's over there on business when unfortunate things happen to him.
Can you tell us a bit more about that, or is that giving too much away?
No, I don't think so, really. So, yes, he's over there on business, running an event for a couple of weeks. Halfway through the event, he's kidnapped by a group of individuals. We don't know too much about it at the time, but because the story is told from multiple viewpoints, we can gradually begin to piece together what's going on.
Mm.
So we have the family back at home in England trying to, you know, wondering what the heck's going on here and trying to make sense of it all and survive. We have the client, Khaled, and his sister, Layla, who happens to be a political activist. She's out on the streets campaigning to get rid of Mubarak and his government. It's just as the 2010 elections were happening in Cairo, or in Egypt. And so a lot of activism going on, a lot of people on the streets campaigning and complaining. And then we have friends of the Ward family in Israel, Shimon and Rachel, who become embroiled in the story too.
Okay, so is a lot of the book trying to work out who's taken him and why and how to get him back?
Exactly.
Yeah, brilliant. So who are the different viewpoints telling the story?
Prime characters, well, Jeff, we've met already. He's incarcerated in Cairo, trying to make sense of the people he's meeting there and their attitude to him and the unpleasant treatment that's being meted out. Then in Egypt, we have Khaled and his sister who are looking for him. Khaled has a boyfriend who is in the police, and it's through that route that he's seeking information, but also through his sister. As I said earlier, she's active out on the streets and has a lot of contacts in many of the universities in Cairo. So that's one route of inquiry down there. And then eventually, Shimon, the family friend in Israel, isn't involved until Jeff's wife, Angie, becomes frustrated with the pace of inquiries and the support she is receiving or isn't receiving from the British government. So she calls Shimon. She knows that his past has taken him into various jobs, various roles for the for the military, and she seeks his help.
And is he the other point of view then?
He is.
Okay, great. And did you plan all of this beforehand? Did you want it to be from three different perspectives, the story?
Yes, I did, because it was very much back to the theme we discussed earlier, which is this this point about similarities, especially now. I mean, it's come of age in a way, because, of course, this was plotted 3 or 4 years ago before what's happening in Israel was happening.
Mm.
So it's certainly shown that perhaps, you know, the view, Shimon's views have much relevance now to what's currently happening in the Middle East.
Yeah. So is this book very different to your first novel, Europia?
Yes, it is. Europia was much more self-contained. There was a single protagonist, far fewer characters, and it was set in one location. But equally, the themes were quite important, quite international, if you like. The themes in Europia are about the experiences of many women in their relationships with men.
Okay.
And that came about through my wife was a teacher at the time, and she would bring home colleagues, young women often, who are involved in internet dating. And we'd sit over dinner and listen to some of these women's experiences. And at the same time, we were having the very active debate about the UK's membership of the EU. And so I put those two together to make Europia.
And did you learn a lot from the writing of the first novel that you were able to either do or not do when writing the second book?
Yes, a huge amount, although I must confess my 10 years trying to write screenplays had a tremendous bearing too, because so many of the maxims, if you like, that we learned writing screenplays were so relevant, I think, to the sorts of novel I was trying to write, the voice I was trying to find as I ploughed through this process. So, yeah, a lot of the learning, yes, was from Europia, you know, keeping things concise, moving things on briskly, not getting bogged down in minutiae. But equally, the, you know, the dramatic issues that used to challenge us when we were writing screenplays came to the fore too.
Yeah. So have you already decided on a third book? Have you thought about what you want to write next?
Yes, the third book's about three quarters of the way through.
Ah, fab.
Yeah.
And you can't tell us anything about it?
At this stage, I think it's best to say that. Well, that's no, I think at this stage I'd rather stay strong on that. Who knows, it may change by the time it actually comes out.
Okay, no problem. Well, in the meantime, if listeners want to get a copy of Some Other Eden, it's out now. It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Anthony Etherington, who we've been chatting with today. Anthony, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Lee Coates, who, after having children, almost gave up on his dream of writing a novel as spare time became a rare commodity. However, a light bulb moment struck during one of his son's extracurricular activities. Those seemingly endless minutes didn't have to be wasted. Now he can often be found writing by the side of football pitches and tennis courts in his hometown of Cardiff. His new novel is a dark psychological thriller set in Cardiff, following Simon and his young son as they try to rebuild their lives after the tragic death of his wife years earlier. Their newfound tranquility shatters when a local schoolboy mysteriously dies, revealing a disturbing pattern of incidents involving children. It's called Smiley Face. Welcome to the book show, Lee.
Oh, it's lovely to be here. I really enjoyed talking with you last time, so thanks for having me back.
Oh, pleasure. Lovely to have you with us again. And I love that picturing you standing by the side of football pitches writing novels. It's brilliant.
It's not the nicest of locations, but yes, it's usually in car parks or by the side of a football pitch. Yeah, sometimes it's in the rain. you can never tell.
Yeah, love it. So what was the kind of inspiration for this latest novel then? Because it sounds quite dark.
Well, as with my first book, before I started writing, I asked myself what scared me. And I couldn't believe I'd not thought about this before, but it is parenting, looking after kids, raising them. It's one of the most terrifying things imaginable. And also the most prolonged, you know, it never really goes away. My own lads are 12 and 9, and they're constantly a source of worry. The parameters have obviously changed since they were babies, but now there's just new and inventive ways for them to strike fear, just to strike fear in you every single day. For instance, when I was their age, I was out all day playing football or whatever from dawn till dusk. My mum and dad were great parents, and that was okay back then. No one bat an eyelid. But now my sons have reached that age where they want to be a bit more free range. But the thought of them roaming the streets alone is a bone-chilling prospect. So that was one part of it. And the other part was a constant worry as well, is that you're somehow failing your kids, you know, that you're constantly worrying that maybe you haven't been the best parent. And this usually comes up when you're at the school gates or conversing on WhatsApp. Everyone seems to be doing better than you are. Other parents sometimes even come across as being competitive, sometimes like aggressively so. But what's really happening in 90% of those cases is that they're just searching for like a barometer or a benchmark to measure their own kids against, because everyone is desperately crying out for a frame of reference. You know, there's no textbook as such. Well, there's plenty of textbooks. There's no one defining textbook. Parents are always trying to validate their own efforts as a parent. So, parenting can be a very isolating experience, I think. And so those are all the worries and fears that I tried to encapsulate with the story.
Yeah. So tell us about Simon. What's he like?
Well, he's very much like me. He wants to do the best possible job for his son, but his wife died tragically in Madeira just over a year before, and he's very much of the feeling that you can get away, you can get through in life by just smiling. You know, you can put a smile on your face, you'll get through most things, you know, that kind of stiff upper lip kind of mentality. So he's trying to imprint that on his son, but it's very difficult because they're both still grieving. So he's just about coming to grips with putting his life back together, but he's struggling. And I think the book maybe explores the fact that his son's coping better than he is.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, grief, isn't it? Just like there's no rule book for parenting, there's no rule book for grief either. It's a very personal thing. There's no right or wrong way to deal with it, and everybody has to find their own way of coping with it.
That's it, right? You know, the timelines are always going to be different for different individuals, and when you've got a kid as well, how much grief do you want to transfer to your son? How much grief should you be showing? How much have you even had the talk about death with your children? It's if they've not had pets before, it can be a very new and frightening thing, you know, if they've not experienced it before.
Yeah. So what can you tell us about Simon's son?
Well, he's much like my own kids, he's football mad. He loves playing with his friends. He just lives for playing football, and he's a member of a quartet of close friends. They all live on the same street, and as a result, the parents of those four kids have created like a WhatsApp group, so to keep in contact and arrange lifts to these various football matches. But Dan is very resourceful. He's very clever. He's also quite insightful. He's quite sensitive and thinks about a lot of things. The only trouble is he's not a very good listener, and I think that's probably quite commonplace amongst kids his age. He'll often hear but not properly listen.
Yeah. And you mentioned WhatsApp groups. That comes into the story a fair bit, the kind of misunderstandings and anxiety that can be caused in WhatsApp groups.
Exactly. It's a lot of my book is about miscommunication, and it's told from multiple points of view, some parents, some children. And what Smiley Face shows, or hopes to show, is that sometimes those perspectives don't necessarily marry up. A child may well perceive some events very differently from an adult and vice versa. And then just to exacerbate matters, like most parents nowadays, WhatsApp or other digital channels are used widely, but can sometimes be a source of further miscommunication. You know, just one misplaced emoji, it can completely misconstrue what a message is trying to say. So that's also explored in the story as well.
Yeah, and you've got personal experience of that, the WhatsApp groups and things.
Yes, I've got so many to mention, but a scene in the book that's taken directly from my history was we had a birthday party. We arranged a birthday party for my youngest, and we had, I think, six of his closest friends around to the house. And whenever you invite kids that age to your house just suddenly shrinks. It's your house seems a lot smaller, and it's a real pressure cooker. And but we survived. I think it was about 2 hours long, and afterwards, me and my wife just sat down, slumped down, completely exhausted. Had a glass of wine, and we were saying, "Oh, that was really hard work," and we didn't realise that my youngest was actually recording my voice and very nearly sent it to the WhatsApp group.
Oh, God. That
originally organised the party.
Oh, no. Oh, so, it's so easy to do, isn't it?
It is. It's yes. So ever since then, I've kept a close hold of my phone.
Yes, definitely. Oh, dear. Well, if people want to get a copy of Smiley Face, it's out now. It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Lee Coates, who we've been chatting with today. Lee, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Anna. Lovely talking to you.
Spanish fishers in Galicia in the northwest are reporting what they're calling catastrophic collapse in shellfish stocks. They say some stocks have fallen by as much as 90% in the space of a few years. In 2023, the crop of cockles fell by 80% compared to the previous year.
Stephen Ritson.
What do they think is behind this? Climate change is the culprit, thanks in part to recent torrential rains that have reduced the salinity of the rías. Adds fresh water, less salt water in that area. The mussels need the salt water, not the fresh water. Right, gone.
Europe Today.
Weekdays from midday.
There you go. Just yet another example of probably to do with climate change. Yeah, probably.
Europe Today. Brought to you by Castle Rock International Law and Investments. Enjoy financial freedom with the Equity Release Programme for over 65s. As advertised in the Euro Weekly News.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Talk Radio Europe.
Your voice in Spain.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to the second part of tonight's book show. In the first hour, we were chatting with Celia Silvani, Anthony Etherington and Lee Coates. In this hour, we're joined by Barney Campbell, who served in the British Army for 6 years. His previous novel, Rain, was inspired by his experiences in Afghanistan. His new novel, The Fires of Gallipoli, is a heartbreaking, sweeping portrayal of friendship and its fragility at the very limits of humanity. We're also chatting to Jana Brooke Wallach, whose debut novel Naked Girl has been named a semi-finalist for the 2024 Publishers Weekly Book Life Prize in Fiction. It spotlights a dysfunctional 1980s Miami Beach family in a stirring coming-of-age story. Though it's not autobiographical, it reads like a memoir, looking at the struggles of fitting in and the power of hope, humour and imperfect love. Also chatting to Andy Pliego, who began writing stories when she discovered she could actually wield her overactive imagination for good. A lover of stories with teeth, she writes books involving mind games, dark humour, general murder and mayhem, characters pushed to the edge of themselves, and most importantly, finding hope in the dark. You Are Fatally Invited is about six thriller authors on a writing retreat. It's a twisty, gripping love letter to mystery novels. And finally on tonight's book show is Nina Winter, who writes books about complicated love and even more complicated family relationships. Still Falling for You is about a second chance, enemies to lovers romantic comedy following Holly, who is reeling from her boyfriend's infidelity and the loss of her dream job. Starting anew as a teacher, her fresh start is complicated when she discovers her mentor is her first love, who broke her heart decades ago. And that is tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
The pen's in my hand, ending unplanned. Staring at the blank page before you, open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate.
Joining us on the line now is Barney Campbell. He served in the British Army for 6 years. His previous novel, Rain, was very much inspired by his experiences in Afghanistan and was published in 2015. He's with us on the book show to talk about his latest novel, The Fires of Gallipoli. It's about Edward Salter, a shy, reserved lawyer whose life is transformed by the outbreak of war in 1914. It's a heartbreaking, sweeping portrayal of friendship and its fragility at the very limits of humanity. Welcome to the book show, Barney.
Hannah, thank you very much indeed for having me on. It's great to be here.
Great to have you with us. So there was a definite inspiration for this book particularly as well, wasn't there? Because you've been to Gallipoli.
Yes. So I was, as you said, I was in the British Army, and just before I went away to Helmand Province in Afghanistan in 2009, ages ago now, I went to go and do a bit of travelling around the west coast of Turkey. And on my way back to Istanbul to get my flight home, I had about 3 days spare that were kind of empty. And so I thought, well, let's go and, you know, explore the Gallipoli Peninsula and discover a bit about the campaign that took place there in 1915, 1916. And I travelled around the peninsula by myself. It was almost deserted, and it was incredibly haunting and evocative. And I became fascinated by the campaign and by the because of the kind of that very ghostly atmosphere that was there in spades for my trip there. And over the years, I learned a bit more. I did some more research about the campaign. And so when I then came to write this novel, my second novel, I wanted to do it in the First World War, I thought to myself that actually, you know, there haven't been many novels set in Gallipoli. And so decided to use that experience as the basis for this novel. So it's absolutely, as you said, anchored in a very meaningful experience.
Yeah. And why do you think that the Gallipoli campaign isn't as well known and written about as like the Western Front, for example?
It's fascinating that. I mean, I think from the British point of view, it's not as well known as the Western Front. We in the UK have tended to, especially as the decades have passed since the First World War, have tended to focus our national consciousness or our national memory of the First World War around, you know, France and Flanders, as have the French. I mean, understandably, the war to take place on their territory, but for other countries, you know, the Gallipoli campaign is utterly totemic to their experience and their memory of the war. Not obviously for the Turks, for whom Gallipoli is absolutely key in their national memory, but also for the Australians and New Zealanders, who actually in a way tend to focus their national memory on Gallipoli instead of the Western Front. Although tens of thousands of Anzacs, as the Australians and New Zealanders were known, also took part in the Western Front battles, and I think for the British memory, the fact that it wasn't successful it means that we don't really tend to focus on it, but also the far greater and numbers of our soldiers served in France and Flanders. So that's, I think, why as the years have gone on, it kind of slips under the radar more and more.
Mm. So for people who don't know a lot about this part of history, then what exactly was the Gallipoli campaign? What took place there?
So at the end of 1914, the British government realised that the First World War wasn't going anywhere, and this was going to be a long and hard conflict, and that was going to be won and lost in the North Sea and on the Western Front, in France and Flanders, and France and Belgium. The government, led by Herbert Asquith, wanted to see if there was any way in which we could shorten the war, could lessen it. Was there a shortcut to preventing us, spending vast amounts of money and using vast amounts of material and obviously, expending a huge amount of men's lives in fighting this conflict? Was there any way we could bring this to a quick conclusion? And the idea, as come up with by the first Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill at the time, was that if you could go into the Eastern Mediterranean and knock Turkey out of the war, who had recently become a German ally, then potentially you could relieve pressure on the Russians on the Eastern Front, where they were fighting Germany and the Austro-Hungarian forces, and kind of bring the war to a quicker conclusion by that means. To do that, you've got to go and capture Istanbul, as it was known then, Constantinople. But to get to Constantinople, you've got to get through what's known as the Dardanelles Straits, which is this body of water that separates the Mediterranean from the Sea of Marmara. And to get control of the Dardanelles, you've got to seize the left flank of those straits, well, which is the Gallipoli Peninsula, which is a piece of land about 2 miles wide by about 15 miles long. And so that was what we dropped, what the British and Australians, New Zealanders and some French forces as well tried to do, was to seize this peninsula, by doing so open up the Dardanelles Straits and therefore open up the way to Istanbul / Constantinople. And on April the 25th, 1915, the forces landed there, but quickly became enmeshed in a very bloody stalemate that after later on in the year, 1915, in November or so, it was decided to evacuate the MEF, as it was known, the Mediterranean Expeditionary Force. And that evacuation took place in December 1915 and January 1916. And the campaign essentially came to naught. But it was very ambitious in scope, and just wasn't executed well enough to enable it.
Mm. So tell us about your main character, Edward.
Yes, so as you said, Edward Salter is a, at the start of the book, when we meet him, he's about 24, 25 years old, and he is quite... he's quite a nervous type. He's quite shy, and he's in the army. He's going out to fight, take part in the Gallipoli campaign. And in the very first chapter, he meets a young man called Theodore Thorne, Theo, who is about 2 or 3 years younger than Edward, and they establish a very, very quick and very close friendship. And Theo, who's very kind of charismatic, quite outgoing, very sure of himself, without he's not an arrogant man, but he's just sort of a very appealingly confident guy. And Edward and him, he really kind of brings Edward out of his shell. And Edward kind of becomes the best version of himself around Theo. And together, you know, they go into the fighting and they undergo a real test of their mettle and of their character with all the incredible bloody violence that they experience in on the Gallipoli Peninsula. But they kind of, their friendship, you know, sustains both of them. And what the rest of the book asks is that when they're split up after the Gallipoli campaign, which they both survive, which is probably a massive spoiler, I shouldn't have given away, but they then get split up, and the book really asks, you know, can a friendship survive being split up? Can it survive them no longer being around each other? And I won't give any more away than that. It's really a book about friendship and what it can, the deep sort of joy and meaning it can bring, but also the fragility of friendship and what happens when that friendship kind of goes off the rails a bit or is forced off the rails. That's what the book kind of, the question the book asks, and hopefully, you know, at the end gives a few answers.
Yeah, that's a really interesting one, isn't it? That must have happened so often with all of the wars, you know, that these people become really close friends and almost like family fighting together and in these awful situations. And obviously people lost a lot of friends along the way. But if they do survive at the end of the war, when they go back to their homes, that could be opposite ends of the country or even in different countries, whether they ever see each other again, it must be very strange.
Yeah, you're bang on, and it's a really interesting phenomenon, and it's actually a phenomenon that, you know, everyone has. I mean, you know, all the periods of one's life when you're forced into, you know, through circumstance, into quite an intense relationship, friendship with people. For instance, at your school, maybe when you're travelling, certainly in the workplace, you can be working, you know, working and living cheek by jowl with someone for many hours of a day and, you know, weeks and months at a time, and become very close to them. But what then happens when that colleague of yours leaves the job and then goes away, and maybe to a different country or whatever? Is it possible to keep that, the intensity of that relationship alive? And of course, in some respects, it absolutely is. But in so many others, you know, all of us have lives in which we've picked up very close relationships that have then, you kind of slightly fallen by the wayside as one's own life experience moves on from that particular friend. That's not necessarily a bad thing, and it doesn't necessarily mean that you're any less fond of them. But I think it is testament to the fact that with so much of life, you know, circumstance is so integral to the formation and the maintenance of so many of the relationships that we establish throughout the course of our lives.
Mm, I bet a lot of these people involved in wars as dramatic as this, if they did get together however many years later, I bet it was really emotional.
Yeah, completely. And actually, you know, as a having served in the military myself, I know that whenever I go to a, not necessarily a formal reunion, but whenever I, you know, see an old a comrade of mine or someone I was friendly with in the military, it's quite funny because you know, despite the years that have passed and despite the kind of the physical changes and the changes in circumstance that one's undergone, you actually establish, you know, the old kind of that old friendship, that old banter, that old sense of humour, kind of very, very quickly. And the years kind of fall away, mm-hmm. and you become in an instant that kind of 24-year-old version of yourself that you were when you established the friendship, or however old you were, and that's really attractive, and I think very, and very, very meaningful, and again, that's a real question that this an issue I think that this the Fathers of Gallipoli tries to pose and to explore.
Yeah, because you've shared something that people who haven't shared, it's very difficult to explain, and for people on the outside to truly understand what you've gone through together and what you've experienced. So having that connection is really special.
Exactly. There's no need to translate. You know, there's no need to kind of find the language to adequately convey that experience. You just know that the other person has had it as well. And again, this is not fundamentally not exclusive to military service whatsoever. This is a phenomenon in friendships that can be between old schoolmates, between old colleagues in all manner of jobs, between old traveling companions, sort of that kind of thing. And in fact, to switch to the military a bit again, and that's what I've tried to do in both this book and my previous novel Rain, is to try to act as a bridge between civilians who don't know much about what people's behavior like is in wartime, and displaying, you know, and helping them to understand a bit about, you know, what it is that takes place, and the emotions that take place amongst those people who are engaged in combat operations, and try to sort of help bridge that gap between that gap in understanding, I think, between the two parties. So the soldier who's been away, and his or her family and friends and contacts, etc. And sometimes it's quite difficult to put that experience into language that everyone can understand. And what I'm trying to do with these two books is to try to help people, you know, bridge that gap. And hopefully, after reading Fathers of Gallipoli, firstly, you know, readers will be entertained and moved. That's the primary aim of this book. But secondly, you know, if I've helped the readership to understand, you know, the experience not only of people who fought in the First World War, but also of people who have fought in wars more generally, then I'll be, you know, absolutely delighted by that.
And it's great how fiction can really inspire students as well, how they can learn a bit more about history through fiction.
I couldn't agree more. I think fiction is such a good vehicle for education. Because you allow the readers to learn without really realizing they're being taught. And that's the key thing in terms of, because in Fathers of Gallipoli, there's several real life characters. Lord Kitchener, the Secretary of State for War, makes it, is quite a significant part and role in it. And there's a few other real life characters. And it does deal a bit with the history and the whys and wherefores of the Gallipoli campaign, as well as the build up to the Battle of the Somme in 1916, and some stuff that takes place post war in Constantinople. But all the sort of the history lessons, you're getting in there in kind of an bleak way, primarily using the novel as a means of entertainment, but having it in the background, the reader hopefully learning something as well. I mean, the example I always use with this is, you know, the amazing Hilary Mantel. I mean, you know, one of the UK's greatest ever writers, you know, and her Wolf Hall trilogy, which is, you know, was a complete kind of monument. You know, the amount, you know, she is taught, you know, I think certainly hundreds of thousands, probably millions of people, about Thomas Cromwell and about life in the court of Henry VIII. Now, if she'd just done a biography of Thomas Cromwell, she'd probably have educated, I don't know, 30,000-40,000 people.
Yeah.
And because people just aren't going to go and pick up that, or the volume of readership aren't going to go and pick up that kind of book. But to do it via a novel, which is a far sort of mass market, or you get far greater access to the mass market readership, is just a brilliant way of providing education. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, what you've got to do is you've got to make sure you've got a responsibility incumbent on you that, yeah, you've got some freedom of movement and how you portray your characters, but you can't just go making up stuff left, right, and centre. You've got to be anchored in you know, due historical diligence and fact finding and very kind of responsible research. But you can use the novel as a means of entertainment to really help, you know, educate people. And again, crucially, without realizing that they're being taught, because if they did, they'd switch off in their droves.
And lovely that you've had a quote from Alexander McCall Smith for the book. That's nice.
Yes, I mean, I'm a huge admirer of his. He's a great hero, and to have the endorsement from someone like him is a huge confidence boost. Because of course, when you're having a novel come out, it's a real, you know, you just don't know how it's going to go. I mean, you think it's all right, you know, you're pretty sure that your publishing team, you know, wouldn't let it get out the gate if they didn't think it was all right, but you still kind of are very nervous. And to have that endorsement from such a well-loved, you know, and real, you know, key figure in English literature, it was so amazing to have that. Really, yeah. Really fortunate.
Nice. Well, if people want to get a copy of The Fires of Gallipoli, it's out now and available on our website, tre.radio. It's by Barney Campbell, who we've been chatting with today. Barney, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure to come on. Thank you very, very much indeed for having me.
Hello, little Alan Bennett here. If I'm not writing books, then the thing I like most is listening to the book club on Talk Radio Europe. Fancy.
Joining us on the line now is Jana Brooke Wallach, whose debut novel Naked Girl has been named a semi-finalist for the 2024 Publishers Weekly Book Life Prize in Fiction. It's already won several indie book awards, and it spotlights a dysfunctional 1980s Miami Beach family in a stirring coming-of-age story. Though not autobiographical, it certainly reads like a memoir. It talks of the struggles of fitting in and the power of hope, humour and imperfect love. Welcome to the book show, Jana.
Thank you so much, Hannah. Thank you for having me. It's great
to have you with us. And where did you get the idea for this novel from? It, as I say, it reads like it's autobiographical, but it's not, is it?
It does. And that there is like a really kind of organic reason why that happened, which was I was having a stay-at-home mom existential dilemma. Like, I was having a crisis of brains watching children's shows and taking care of three babies day in and day out. And I needed something to keep the adult part of my brain from withering and dying. And so I thought, oh, I'll write some memoirs. And I did start writing some memoirs about my also kind of offbeat, but not nearly as offbeat as Sienna and Siddhartha's in the book, childhood growing up in Miami Beach in the 80s. And so I was writing kind of in first person about my own self. And quickly I realized, oh, wait, I love my family and I want them to keep loving me too. So I cannot write these things honestly. Not that there was some big secret, but just, you know, it's critical to write a memoir often, unless you're writing a memoriam. And so I stopped doing that and I was like, well, what if I just write kind of a fake memoir and I use this setting and all and this time, but I make something else happen. And so I just started writing the book that way, but it really was kind of an exercise for fun and a hobby. And then I started realizing that it was interesting me and the story was going somewhere. So I started writing it as a book.
Yeah, great. So can you tell us a little bit about what it was like for you growing up in Miami Beach in the 80s?
Sure. So a lot of bit of it was being Gen X, and any Gen Xers listening or baby boomers who are the parents of Gen Xers. And for those others listening, I'm sure you're sharing memes about it on social media all the time. I just saw one recently that said Gen X raised on hose water and neglect. And so as much as our parents loved us, worked hard and took care of us, the culture was to leave us to ourselves. We had working mothers, we had working fathers, we were out on our bikes. No one had a water bottle. You might have a canteen left over from summer camp, but you didn't bring it with you. Just drank from someone's hose. It was so we were in the streets. We were out. There was something on the news in the States, which was it's 10 o'clock. Do you know where your children are? that was That was legitimate. And we just we ran amok in a great way and in kind of a dangerous way. And there was no cell phones. There was no life tracking or whatever that is called. And so there was that part. And then my part was that was personal to me was my parents divorced when I was very young. They were not the right people for each other. It wasn't a bad thing that they split, but I was a toddler and my brother was a toddler and my mother remarried my stepfather when I was 5 years old. And my brother was 3 and a half. He had two girls who are my sisters and they had a baby together, our baby brother. So there were five of us in this step family, which was kind of conventional. And I went to elementary school during the week and I went to Hebrew school and I went to gymnastics class and youth group. And I did all of these conventional things and I ate Little Debbie's and I ate Velveeta macaroni and cheese. And then on the weekends, my dad was kind of seeking because he found himself married in the late 60s. And never really figured out who he was. And he got a little hippie and he lived in a commune for a while. And he experimented with psychedelics and pot and like-minded seeking friends. And on the weekends, I was kind of hanging out with that. So it was a very dichotomous thing for me to go back and forth from being naked in a blanket, munching on an organic carrot at a farmer's market to being, you know, spraying my bangs high with Aquanet and trying to look like Madonna during the week.
Wow. And when you look back at your childhood, does it make you smile? I mean, do you look back with mostly fond memories?
I do. I look back on it very fondly. I've gone to therapy for all of the things that I don't look back on fondly, and we've all talked it out. But the rest of it was so, I love that I had two completely different worlds because I kind of wound up somewhere in between and I got that choice where I feel like most people with only one family or even two families that are similar to each other, they have this one way of being. They learn this one way of being. And I got to be sort of it kind of broke the fourth wall for me. So I could see that I didn't take for granted that this was just the way families were. I had it so different.
Yeah.
I got to make choices. Yeah.
So tell us about your main character in Naked Girl.
Sienna Shiva Karma Jones is her actual name. And she is the product of, and this is not a spoiler because you find it out right in the prologue. Her mother has overdosed and died at a very young age. And her father is this narcissistic seeker, very, very concerned with himself and his own grandness. And she is this very aware little girl, which I think we all are more aware as children than adults perceive us to be. We're taking in like sponges, and she is very conscious of the fact that they're different. She's very conscious of being an outsider, and she's almost obsessed with finding a new mother, creating a proper home for her and her brother, and fixing all of this insecurity and instability that she's going through.
Yeah. And did you enjoy writing her?
I love writing her. She's very similar to me in a lot of ways, in terms of that presentness as a child and sort of being almost a journalist as a child, taking notes on her surroundings and trying to figure out what to do with this mess she's in. And I feel for her because she's got a lot on her plate and she doesn't get to relax as a child. She doesn't get to just sort of run free screaming and spin till she falls down. The things that we all miss about childhood and that we say youth is wasted on the young. She's definitely that proves the rule that youth is wasted on the young because she is trying so hard to manage and mother and figure out her situation. And it takes so much of her little energy and her mind that she's never really just letting it go and being free.
Mm. And does she have friends?
She does and she doesn't. She thinks of her little brother who's only, you know, a year and a bit younger than her as almost her charge, and her son almost, but he is her everything and her best friend. The two of them are very much a family. And then she makes friends in her, you know, her having friends or not is kind of a big part of the story. what she seeks for herself. She wants to have friends like she sees on Growing Pains and on The Facts of Life. She wants to have an 80s TV show family. And she talks about that. There's a lot of 80s references in the book. And what she has is her father, her brother, and the other cult members who worship her father as if he speaks directly to God.
Wow. And where does the title come from, Naked Girl?
The title has kind of a multiple meaning, as many titles do. She is physiologically naked in much of the book, and as are many people in much of the book, because the cult in the book has no issue with nudism. And also she's naked emotionally because she has no protections against the harshness of the world at the time. She's not being protected by parents and she's not being shielded. She's not having things made into bite-sized pieces and child-appropriate ways to be given to her. So she's naked against kind of the weather too.
Yeah. And is the idea that people reading the book will kind of like her and feel for her and be rooting for her?
I do think so. I think they will love her. And they will love Siddhartha and they will be very much rooting for them. And I think the journey of reading the book is following them and hoping for their redemption.
And did you have to do some research into cults and cult behavior and things?
Not too much, only because I'm already kind of fascinated by it. And so already have, I'll always watch any documentary or read any book about it. I think I chose it because it's something that fascinates me and I have a lot of information about. And I think it fascinates many people. Even as we look at others and are fascinated by how they can be just swept up and so gullible, and yet we cannot necessarily examine ourselves and see how we are also swept up and gullible. And if we go deeper and think about ourselves, like, why do you want that handbag so badly? What does it mean to you? Why do you love your sports team so much, or your religion, or your school spirit? Where does that group love come from? And what do you get from society for being involved in it, or for wearing that handbag, or for cutting your hair in that way? That type of feedback that you get from other people, it's really the same thing, but just in a more extreme form in a cult.
Yeah, interesting.
That's why it's fascinating to me, because I think anyone is susceptible, depending on, how much love or not you're getting, or how much validation or not you're getting from the world.
Yeah, for sure. That's a fascinating road to go down, I'm sure. So what's next for you then? Are you deciding to write another book?
I am working on another book. It's wildly different and also so much the same. It's wildly different in that it is a much larger scope. It deals with American politics, religion, and social culture, but also it is still kind of a dysfunctional, family tight, claustrophobic story, even though it has like a much larger scope feeding into it.
Yeah.
And it actually takes place in the not too distant future.
Okay, great. Well, if people want to get a copy of Naked Girl, it's out now and available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Jana Brooke Wallach, who we've been chatting with today. Jana, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was wonderful to be here, and I hope to talk to you again.
That would be great.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Andy Pliego, who began writing stories when she discovered she could actually wield her overactive imagination for good. A lover of stories with teeth, she writes books involving mind games, dark humour, general murder and mayhem, characters pushed to the edge of themselves, and most importantly, finding the hope in the dark. Her new novel is called You Are Fatally Invited. It's about six thriller authors on a writing retreat. It's a twisty, gripping love letter to mystery novels and is a refreshing take on the classic locked room mystery. Welcome to the book show, Andy.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having me, Hannah.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. I love that you're a lover of stories with teeth.
Yes, exactly.
That makes me think of actual teeth.
No, Yes, usually, more often than not, there's teeth involved.
I love that. So it was, I guess it was obvious the kind of books that you wanted to write because of the kind of books you enjoy reading.
Yes, it was always going to be something with a bit of an edge to it, bit of suspense in some way or other. Yes.
Yeah. So how did you come up with the idea of this one then, with all the authors on a writing retreat?
Yeah, so I was strategizing with my wonderful agent it's 2-3 years ago now, and trying to choose between two ideas for an adult thriller novel. One of them was a dinner party locked room mystery, but from the perspective of the person on the inside. So the person manipulating everything and getting, you know, the guests to do something or admit something. And then the other idea was a retelling of And Then There Were None by Agatha Christie, but with thriller and horror authors. And the magic kind of started when I put the ideas together, and then You're Fatally Invited came out of that.
Great. So tell us about this writing retreat and the authors that are on it.
Yes. Yeah, so it is off the coast of Maine on a private island, and an anonymous legendary author named J.R. Alister invites these six authors of thriller and horror books to his private island. And he's never been seen before. He's never done in-person events or anything. But all these authors have grown up or just read his books for years. And so they're absolutely thrilled to get to meet him. And then when they arrive, their host has not arrived yet, supposedly, but they're welcomed to the island by his event coordinator, Mila, who, as we learned from her chapters early on, knows quite a bit more about the retreat than the guests do when they arrive.
Interesting. So when you say her chapters early on, how is the book set out then?
Yes. So I had a lot of fun with structuring it, but the main structure of it is that each day of the retreat, so there are 6 days, each day focuses on a different author. And so we open the book with Rodrigo's perspective. And he's one of the authors who's arriving on the retreat. We learned straight off, he's worried about another guest on the retreat that he knows, and he doesn't want anyone to know that he knows this person. So we know he's got something to hide. And then the first day alternates between his perspective and Mila, the event coordinator. And we learn straight off that things are not what they seem from her. And she has a personal vendetta against one of the authors on the retreat, though we're not sure who. So that's the main structure. And I do have to just say real quickly that the book also has excerpts from the anonymous author's own book on writing fear. And so these little excerpts pepper the book as a bit of a primer about tropes and things that you encounter in thriller and horror books. It plays into the story perhaps a little too conveniently.
Like it. I like the idea of it being kind of told from all those different perspectives. Was that difficult, or did that enable you to tell more of a story, I suppose?
Definitely both. it was very difficult in planning. I had to be so meticulous in planning whose perspective came when and what I could say from their perspective without giving things away prematurely. So making sure each character had an arc and that the things that they would observe or that they knew came out at just the right points took a lot of practice, but I think that it definitely gives a much fuller story than telling it from one point of view. So I kind of always knew that it would be very multi-point of view, very involved from each of the characters. Yeah. Wanted them to feel like stars of their own stories. To some degree.
So do you think the readers will like all of the authors, all of the characters, or is that not the idea?
You know, I think that my hope is that readers will latch on to a couple of them and really see, you know, something of themselves in these authors. And I worked really hard. I know the unlikable narrator, unlikable character trait is rampant in thriller spaces. And while I do enjoy it, I didn't want the book to be quite that way. I wanted you to be able to find something that you loved in each character. And I think that is actually I've kind of accomplished that, because readers seem to be all over the map over which characters they love and which one they had a hard time with, which is, to me, that reads as like, oh, like, good, they're feeling like real people, where some people like them, some people don't, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And can you tell us, without giving too much away, can you tell us a little bit about what happens to some of the characters on the writing retreat?
Yes. So as the authors quickly discover, each day of the retreat is themed after a particular trope from thriller and horror fiction. So when they arrive, they encounter a riddle at dinner, and it's based off of the dinner party trope that I think a lot of readers will recognize, where it's, you know, all these people who've been invited to this dinner, and someone is, or either the host isn't there, or he dies, or, you know, something like that happens. And so they at first think it's all fun and games and just a very themed writer's retreat. And then as the tropes go on and they start, it's not really a spoiler, but they start being killed off in the manner of the tropes in their books. And as soon as they start realizing that, things get real intense real fast. So,
yes, and I guess the reader presumably is in the dark as to who's doing the killings.
Yes, yes. Although we do know that Mila, the Arvent coordinator, she's orchestrated a lot of things, and there's some things that she knows and some things she doesn't, but she definitely has a dark side to her.
So how do you begin to write another book after this? It feels like this is such an intense kind of subject with a lot going on. Did you need a break when you finished it?
I actually, you know, I finished it and I had a good couple months break in between, you know, when the book sold and getting edits. And I've actually already been, you know, I was going to say neck deep, but it's more like over my head in book two. And I'm actually almost finished with, it's, I think, the fifth revision of it. So it's gone through a lot, and this is another one that is similar in scope. It's multi-POV. It's got so much going on, and making sure I can nail down how everything unfolds and how not to make it too overwhelming, but, you know, to gently lead the reader along. I'm in the thick of all of that right now, so it's fun.
Oh, great stuff. And you had some great feedback from some big name authors on this first book, which must have been wonderful.
Oh my goodness. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely stunned at the amazing people who read and loved the book. Yes, such a treat. Names like AJ Finn, Tess Gerritsen, Catherine Ryan Howard, I've been fans of their books for so long, and it's very unreal to see their names on my book.
Yeah, lovely. Well, if people want to get a copy of You Are Fatally Invited, it's available now on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Andy Pliego, who we've been chatting with today. Andy, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much, Hannah. This was wonderful.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Nina Winter. She writes books about complicated love and even more complicated family relationships. Her latest book is called Still Falling for You. It's about a second chance, enemies to lovers romantic comedy following Holly, who's reeling from her boyfriend's infidelity and the loss of her dream job. Starting anew as a teacher, her fresh start is complicated when she discovers her mentor is Alex Bennett, her first love who broke her heart a decade ago. Welcome to the book show, Nina.
Hi, so nice to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. And tell me why you like writing these kinds of books. What is it about relationships and things that you enjoy writing about?
I think I've always been interested in relationships. After all, relationship relationships really drive our lives, whether it's family relationships or friend relationships or romantic relationships. I wasn't particularly really interested what happens if perhaps your family relationships are more strained, and how does that impact on your life choices and, you know, the sort of partner that you look for. So that's where I am.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it, what kind of comes down to us from our parents and how that can affect the choices and decisions that we make.
Yeah, definitely. And that was something that I really wanted to portray in the book, where you have two main characters and they have completely different upbringing. One of the characters seemingly has it all, a perfect life, perfect mum and dad, you know, living in a sort of beautiful house with everything on a silver platter, but actually, you know, it's not really what it is and what it looks like. And on the other hand, you have a character who didn't have any of that and was to a certain extent disadvantaged. And it's really interesting to see them react and, you know, the choices they make based on that.
Yeah. So tell us about Holly.
Well, so Holly is a newly qualified teacher, as you said. She is in her sort of mid-late 20s, and she finds herself at a bit of a standstill in her life. Lots of things go wrong, as you say, and she finds herself in a place where she feels like she wants to give up, but she decides that she's not the sort of person. She's not going to give up. She's going to try and restart her life. So she moves away. She finds a new job. She's ready to restart. She's got her friends, which are really important to her in her life. And so she feels, you know, very positive about her new life. But however, things don't quite work out the way she wanted to. And obviously, starting your school, she finds out that her mentor turns out to be her first love, which gives her a little bit of a setback. But she's not ready to give up. She's quite a stubborn character in that sense. And I do like that about her.
Mm. So tell us about Alex then.
Well, Alex is an interesting character. A lot of people who've read the book said that they did not like him at first. And, you know, to be honest with you, he's had a lot on his plate. And I wanted a character that wasn't likable from the start, but it was a character who did the right thing despite someone saying things wrong. And there's lots of people out there who always have good intentions and they are good people. However, you know, they just don't say things the right way at times. And obviously he's carries this burden with him that makes him slightly sort of a Darcyan character, which I do like because I'm a massive fan of Pride and Prejudice, as probably most of us are.
So do you think people will be rooting for them and kind of wanting them to get together?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, they have tension and they have chemistry between themselves and, you know, and history. And I think all of that combination together alongside obviously Alex always coming to rescue Holly or wanted to help Holly is something that character, the people who read about this character will really want to see. And the closeness within which they grow into as you read the book. So hopefully people will enjoy their relationship and as it develops and deepens.
Mm. So how much of the idea do you have for a book like this before you start writing? Is it all about the characters or the story or the journey that they go on? How clear is the plan?
It's funny because I've been writing for over 10 years now, and I've been trying to find a formula that works for me. But unfortunately, every single book is completely different.
Oh, interesting. So
with this particular book, I had Holly in my head straight away as a fully molded, real person. She was going through a really tough stage of her life, yet on the outside, her life looked perfect. And I do like the idea of it. We love the times we think that somebody has it, you know, air quotes, sorted, but actually it's the complete opposite of it. And I wanted that sort of character. So it started with her. And I've always liked the idea of second chance. I've liked the idea that you have such a first love experience that it's something that you remember for the rest of your life and it doesn't quite work out. But, you know, years and years later, you know, you change as a person, you're in a different situation. The other person is in a different situation as well. And I like the idea of those two people colliding again and seeing what happens. Mm-hmm. So that was the driving force from the start.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, isn't it? Looking at the fact that I think we all will have looked at people and thought, oh, they've got it all right. They've got a nice amount of money, or they've got a nice relationship, or they've got perfect kids, or the perfect house, all the different things that you can easily think are great from the outside. But in reality, no one has the perfect life. No one's completely happy.
Nobody knows what they're doing.
Definitely. So I think a lot of people will relate to the characters. Do you? Is that the idea?
Yes, it's very much about characters that have real feelings, real jobs, real problems, real joys, and all of that combination. I did want to have this book be set in a school because it's something that is really close to my heart. And I just feel like that maybe we don't write enough about teachers.
Yeah. So tell us more about the school setting then.
So I guess it's sort of an amalgamation of lots of different experiences of me being a pupil myself, you know, remembering what high school or secondary school used to be like. So obviously part of the story is set in a secondary school or what students in A-levels. And I remember that awkwardness of the age when everything mattered so much. And you just, if everything was life or death. And I really like that, you know, idea of it, you know, that she's going through all of these things in a secondary school. And then you have the story 10 years later where she's a teacher herself and she's going through obviously a big career change, but also she's at the start of a career. And I feel like newly qualified teachers, it's quite a difficult stage of its own, you know. I myself was a teacher, so I remember going through it, you know, working all these hours and every day stressful. You are, you know, dreaming about teaching. You are constantly planning what you're going to teach and you are observed and all of that. So there's lots of emotions and they run high all the time. And in the midst of it, you know, you encounter your first love, a person who broke your heart. I think it was a little bit sadistic of me to do that, but I just really want to see what happens.
Yeah, it must be difficult to switch off sometimes as a teacher, to come home and relax and not be thinking about what you've got to do the next day.
Yeah, and I think that especially as a newly qualified teacher, which I was years and years ago, I think it's harder to switch because you don't really have the time to switch. You bring, you know, bags and bags of books that you need to mark. You get up early to mark them. You go early to work, you know, to prep for lessons. And then you are in lessons during lunchtime. You are marking more books and, you know, you just never really, you know, switch off. And then there's always training and there's always, you know, meetings and there's always planning for trips and all of these things. And I did want to portray that in the book, and hopefully, you know, I added a little bit of humor because, you know, as much as teaching is really hard, there've been lots and lots of funny times that, you know, you just could not make it up.
Yeah, teachers should definitely be paid more. If people want to get a copy of Still Falling For You, it's out now. It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Nina Winter, who we're chatting to. Nina, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by audible.co.uk. Download one title each month, plus unlimited listening to thousands of Audible originals, podcasts and audiobooks. Just click on the Audible banner at www.tre.radio.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.